This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with artist Lex Jurassic. Welcome, Lex.
Hi there.
Lex, could you describe some of your better-known work?
Well, if I had to sum it up, it'd probably be crestated saguaros. That's probably what most people in Tucson would recognize as my work. Big, voluminous, brightly colored, crested saguaros.
What drew you to this subject matter?
There's nothing not to love about a crested saguaro. It looks as if an alien and a saguaro had a baby and piped frosting all over it. I mean, it's just so unusual. And so, you know, I mean, saguaros tend to blend, but a crested saguaro sticks out like a sore thumb. So I feel like their uniqueness and charm is what draws me to them.
Saguaros are really important figures of our landscape, obviously. And I feel like now they're even more so because we have lost many in fires this season. Mm-hmm. Indigenous people have referred to them as the saguaro people because they are so relatable for us, you know, as humans, right? With their long, tall trunks and then their arms and multiple arms and legs. And when they're crested, sometimes they even seem to have heads. What do you feel spiritually about the crested saguaro?
I mean, I definitely see myself in them. I relate to them because of their uniqueness and because of their like malformation that no one can quite put a finger on why it happens and where it's going to happen. So it's just the weirdo of the landscape. And I really enjoy, and our family enjoys, going out off-roading and just trying to find these guys out there in the desert, hunting for them.
Lex, being that you are from Seattle originally, could you talk to us about having that perspective of coming to Tucson and having an experience where you found your place in the Tucson art community?
First of all, it's nice to live someplace where rain is celebrated. Like anytime it rains, like everyone runs outside and is like, it's raining, as opposed to when I was a child, I remember seeing on the news, they said, the weatherman one morning before school said, oh, it's day 45 of straight rain. And I was like, can you say that again? Because it was just so normal. I really, you know, it's lovely to enjoy rain and have it be a reprieve from the sun. So we had lived in Albuquerque and really loved it. And so coming to Tucson, I'd never been here and I knew I was going to love it just for an affinity for the desert. So finding my place in Tucson as an artist, it really felt like, you know, Tucsonans see other Tucsonans and they really try to triangulate who you are and where you're from. So they'll be like, what high school did you go to? And I'm like, didn't go to high school here. They're like, where have you worked? You're like, I've not really had a job here. Like they really desperately try to place you in this someplace. And when you're not from here, you're just like, I'm not from here. So for me, it was really important to raise my profile and just get some name recognition and let my work speak for itself. And so I made the work and I initially, you know, I applied for shows at Tucson International Airport and DeGrazia, you know, all these points of interest that Tucsonans tend to gravitate towards. And then I did some markets here, which I had never done before, including Cultivate, the Mercado Bazaar, and the TMA Artisan Market. And so that really helped me just feel a part of the community, help the community get to know me. I mean, I like talking to people and I like interacting and I'm curious about people. So it was a good fit for me to just get to know the community better. And that was probably 7 years ago by now.
And I think that's how I first became familiar with your work, as one of my friends was wearing your cactus pad earrings. And I was like, those are fantastic. Where did you get those? And that's kind of was my first exposure to Lex Jurassic.
And I was fully in creating those and the other work made of cactus paddle from mold. I was inspired by DeGrazia and DeGrazia's ceramic work. I mean, hat tip for the, to the man who created art in Tucson and elevated it. You know, I really felt like that work was, you know, in the fiber of Tucson. I mean, you can't do this now, but he literally would just chop the tip off a saguaro arm and make a mold from it.
Well, you had mentioned to me previously that you had done the markets and that you had, you know, found kind of a good vibe in there, but it wasn't something that you wanted to continue to do at a certain point. And I think it's really interesting how, you know, the commercial aspect of art can either be something that an artist aspires for, their like greatest aspiration is to sell their art, or it just starts to become a burden, right? On top of their art, of like having to think about the market while they're producing it.
You really have to create work for a market that is marketable. And I really try to distinguish like the work that is there to be a product, like the earrings, versus work that has no function and is truly art because it's a piece of paper that I painted on, or, you know, it doesn't hang in your ear. You know, for me, it was important to distinguish that. And, you know, summer here very much functions like winter elsewhere. So I was finding that through the summer months in preparation for the liveliness of fall and winter here, I was just fully absorbed in creating smalls to sell. And, you know, not to say I never do that, but it just became this all I was absorbed into it. And for me, after a few years of doing the market, you know, we hit, I remember there was a market that was just right after the election in 2016. And I had been warned like election years are not the best when it comes to holiday sales, depending on how the election goes. And it was just so sad. And it was just like, no one was there and no one wanted to buy. And there was not that holiday vibe. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I work from a place of intuition and knowing when to expand and when to contract and what feels right. And so I said, well, that's been fun. And I think it's served its purpose. But, you know, I don't want to have to work towards a market. So I just stopped.
Lex, you're clearly in love with the Southwest and you take a lot of your subject matter from Arizona's natural world and aesthetic traditions. You know, we talked a little bit about saguaros, but I was hoping you could talk a little bit about too, like this aesthetic tradition, you know, your choice of vibrant colors and, you know, the palette, this kind of more subdued palette that's often associated with the desert Southwest too.
Well, if you're not seeing like neon pink in the landscape, then I feel bad because I feel like it surrounds us all. I mean, I always work from a sense of place, no matter where I lived, whether it's the subject matter or the materials. Like I'll often go out and find when we lived in the Florida Panhandle, I worked with these little limpet shells that I would find and incorporate into sculpture. So I feel like the thing that really runs through all my work is that color. Like I love it. I can't get enough. And for me, it's an emotional resonance that color has that keeps returning, allowing me to return to it. And I do, for me, it's like this, I'm a maximalist. I'm not going to lie. Like more is wonderful. I mean, so for me, like when I see a Southwestern home represented in neutral tones and that whitewashing, To me, that is a northern New Mexico vibe, and it doesn't suit the deep Sonoran desert. Like, we are color, we are vibrance. To me, that stems from this idea, you know, these Victorian colorist theories that color is of the primitive, that pattern is of the tribal, and those things, you know, in a colonial sense, are below, you know, and not foreseen and not tasteful. So for me, color is a form of rebellion. Saguaros, too. Mm-hmm. Saguaros are, you know, it's less put a bird on it and put a saguaro on it. Like, there is people are drawn, rightfully so, to the aesthetic of the southwestern part of this country. It's incredible, it's wonderful. But then they couple it with this not actually having they have a visual sense of it, but they don't actually have a sense of what it is like to live here. And there is no other place that experiences heat like we do, experiences multiculturalism like we do, and border life. So people have this affinity for the Southwest coupled with this like fear of the Southwest, fear of the borderlands, and a false sense of what it's like to live here. I mean, I'm always saying to, you know, people like, look, I don't tell a lobster fisherman how to fish lobster. Why do people have opinions on the border when they have no idea of what it's like here and how wonderful and magical and amazing it is?
Absolutely. You know, it's always been a weird juxtaposition that, you know, people in Washington make decisions about how people live and die on the border when, you know, for the most part, we're living pretty harmoniously here, you know, in Tucson, 60 miles from Mexico. You know, those of us who are allowed to live harmoniously and who are not pushed into the desert to die by border militarization.
Yeah, I was told before I moved here that the further you get from the border, the more scared people are of it. And it's totally true. I mean, I grew up in Washington State. I grew up with the same proximity to the Canadian border, same issues on some level. And it was not like, oh my God, Canada.
Lex, we are, as we're discussing, in interesting political times. You know, I wondered if you could say a little bit more about when Trump was elected. You kind of felt like, maybe I don't want to do creation that is so utilitarian. Maybe I want to do something that's less connected to the market. Like, was that a form of resistance for you?
For me, my process and creating art has always been intertwined with coping. And for me as a child, I was very ill. On and off because of my asthma. So finding solace in work and focusing on art, whether it's just laying there in bed as a kid and drawing, really, it helped me develop a way of coping through difficult situations. So not just with the election of Trump, but with the onset of COVID, I felt like, oh, I am made for this. I'm here to work. That's what I want to do is work. I love the fact I'm not obligated to leave my house, which my therapist made a note of when I said I could never leave the house again. For me, I found solace in my process. I feel like I always will through difficult times.
You had mentioned that you found comfort through repetition in your work.
When I was young, the work I would do was repeatedly draw dress designs in like a $1.50 grocery store sketchbook my mom would get for me. And for me, I extend that as an adult into my process of creating usually a series and usually on the same subject that I can really just get lost in. So I just found something that really hooked me at the beginning of COVID, And I've taken that work, I call them flower mounds, and just continually get lost in them. And I've not just taken them on a subject matter, but I've kind of like teased it out in different ways, in sculptures, in creating paper, and just really, it's began as a way to actively paint myself happy and keep myself positive. And now it's kind of evolved into this, boy, do I miss the outside world. Boy, do I miss the landscape and being out in nature, like a pining for a lost love.
Could you describe your flower mounds for people who maybe haven't seen them?
It's just what you would imagine. It's a globular, voluminous, budding, joyful blob. And sometimes they're a landscape, and sometimes they're a super bloom, and sometimes they're a flower field and just laid out like a carpet. And sometimes there's nothing but just a pile of flowers and petals. Doesn't that sound fun? It's a great place to be.
And I think I've seen some of them that you've painted over Polaroids.
I did a few on vintage photos that I got at a thrift store. I found a whole album. And the flower mounds became part of domestic life. They started participating in washing dishes and holding babies. And some came back from Vietnam, but it's kind of like it was a way to like strip away the figurative and the human and just bring us down to that like vibration of cells and liquid that we all essentially are.
Well, and I love the concept of painting, you know, a joyful flower mound on top of a maybe otherwise not so joyful vintage photo as a way of kind of revising history or controlling a reality where you just, you know, take a reality and then just put your own reality just right on top of it. You know, it's so freeing in this situation that we're living in where it feels like so much is out of our control.
Well, and I was very mindful of like even starting on painting on the photos. Like they're someone's history, they're someone's memories. I had them for quite a while. And I mean, for me, I enjoy just looking at old photos and just letting my curiosity just grab me and go, what is happening here? But then I got to interject my goopy mounds into them. And I don't know, I feel like it lends another dimension.
I am really into this topic of using art to cope with, you know, some of the challenges of our current situation, and joy, and how to infuse joy, and how do different people infuse joy. And it's kind of almost like an unpopular subject. I feel like it's really difficult to even say, hey, this, to go out and publicly say, hey, this brings me joy, because it's like, wow, should I even say that when so much is wrong with the world? Like, should I even talk about anything positive when there's so much injustice going on and, you know, so much loss going on? And I also think that we kind of, as an American culture, are resistant to positivity. It completely flies in the face of Anglo-Protestant work ethic that this country was built on. So could you talk a little bit more about that, the queer potential of joy and how you are experiencing it personally?
Well, I will never apologize for being happy. And I feel like if you are a part of an oppressed community, you are intentionally re-traumatized and re-triggered, and they want you to not find that joy and not be able to be happy. Like, that's the whole MO. So as a person who struggled with anxiety, I always felt like, oh, anxiety is like having, you know, an alarm going off in your house, but there's no one breaking in, just this alarm going off. And I've had this, and there's a benefit from that. It's, you know, you're always on high alert. But then I really had to find that radical happiness within myself and know that, like, the happier I am, when the alarm is actually triggered, I can come from a place of being relaxed and being happy and being joyful and having a better perspective on it. My therapist is going to love what I'm saying right now. I find the most rebellious part of queer culture is the act of radical happiness and the celebration, and celebration as a sacred act of grieving. And I think a lot about the people who returned to the Pulse nightclub after the shooting and being fully judged, like, how dare you dance while you cry? And, you know, when you are not allowed to be a part of a church and you are not welcome in other sacred spaces because of who you are as a member of the LGBTQ community, then do not judge when I smile. Do not judge how I grieve, and that I find solace and church in dancing the night away.
Which, you know, there's actually a whole field in cultural studies around, it's called affect. And it's this kind of study of what is a appropriate emotional response, what is an inappropriate emotional response, right? Like, how can we find some sort of disruptive potential with an inappropriate emotional response, quote unquote, right? Like, who determines what an appropriate or inappropriate emotional response is? How is that in itself connected to power? And how are we subverting power when we respond differently? And you're totally right. I mean, joy is one thing that we cannot allow to be stripped from our lives by the oppressor, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, and we can't be told not to be joyful. Mm-hmm. Like, there's always, like, this sense of, like, well, if you're poor, then why do you have a cell phone? You know, if you're depressed, then why are you hanging out with people? You know, it's like, you can't win. So being happy really pisses off people. And it's not easy to be happy. It's, you have to work at it. And happy is a very, like, loose term, you know. Finding value and joy and delight in your day takes work. And it's a mental mind shift. And I think that's why you see people baking bread and, you know, binge watching TV shows right now and finding solace in these small ways. It's because they are delightful. And you can't tell me to go to work. Like, you can't make me leave my house. So you can't come for my bread.
Well, and, you know, if you dissect that kind of Anglo-Protestant, you know, work ethic that modern capitalism is built off of, it's that, you know, an enjoyment of and leisure is practically sinful. And it's the self-sacrificing and the labor and, you know, the misery that makes you have earned your keep, right? So being joyful and really expressing pleasure flies in the face of that in a way that is very culturally resistant.
I was told, you know, the Puritan mentality is someone's having fun somewhere and we have to stop it. So there's always going to be someone telling you. I mean, I remember being at Costco with a family member and they were like, everyone here is chatting. How dare they? This is work. And it's like, why shouldn't you be able to whistle while you work?
Yeah, and I think millennials have presented a bit of a challenge to that just generationally too, because they're so much less interested in creating these, like, really clear boundaries between the rest of their life and their work life. Instead, they kind of blend everything together a lot more. Which I think a lot of older generations find frustrating and don't know how to manage them for that reason. But I think there could be a lesson in that.
I mean, for me, you know, when people ask me, like, hey, what's your advice to a young artist? It's not necessarily, like, blend everything together. I mean, find joy and beauty in everything, but sometimes it's great to have a job that's just a job and make your art without that intention of it being a product. Like, it's not always about running a small business. That's called my passion.
Right.
That can be overwhelming. Like, why not work at the bakery counter at Safeway and pursue my passion and prioritize my time? I mean, I do that as a parent. I've always prioritized and stayed at home with my child and prioritized my art above everything else. And that's brought me the most joy in life. When people say you can't have it all as a woman, I'm like, well, I set up my life that's right for me to have it all. And I find joy in all that.
I was reading Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, which in some ways is a really frustrating read because it's, very much like a white privilege lens books. But by the same token, she's got a lot of really valid, I think, perspective in it. And one of the things she says is approach your art with a sense of entitlement. And I think you practically have to have you have to summon entitlement around your art in order to make sure that you carve out that space for it. You have to like really assert a right to have that art as a priority in your life in order to make it happen, or the pressures of our capitalist society will restructure your life for you.
To me, entitlement is not where the space I operate from, but I feel like creating my art is the greatest act of blind faith in my life. And maybe the only act of faith in my life. Like when people say, like, you just gotta go with the Bible and have faith. Like for me, like, I'm making this work. I don't know why. It stems from a compulsion. It stems from repetition. And, you know, I feel like there's a otherworldly dimensional quality that maybe I peeped into it once at a young age of, you know, the work that you see is the tip of the iceberg on some level. And there's this breadth of spiritual depth to it. But for me, it's 100% not entitlement, but that's really is a white lady way to say faith. It's a spiritual act. It's a spiritual submission that I only can liken to when, you know, people that are devout and faithful talk about their faith.
Lex, I often ask people about their artistic root, and I wondered if you could tell us a story about, you know, maybe your earliest forays into art, maybe something from your childhood.
You know, a story that I really wanted to share, but it's really more about like airing dirty laundry. I got a beef and I want everyone to hear it. And this is the first time I'm telling this story.
I love it.
Okay, not even my therapist has heard this. I've had a lot of time to reflect. Okay, so when I was young, and I do the same for my daughter, and I did a lot of art contests, you know, like at the grocery store. I will say that I'm not a stage mom, but I forced my daughter to participate in these same art competitions. And last year she won Tucson birthday stamp contest. God bless the postal service. As a child, my mom came home and said, hey, there's this contest for fire safety. You had to create a poster about fire safety. So we went to the stationery store and I bought like a big piece of cardstock that had like, you know, wood grain on it. And I created like a game, like a Monopoly style game. And I put like fake money on it and pieces. I mean, I really, this wasn't just your basic poster. And I won this contest and I got to become fire chief for the day. Winning that meant that I got to go to the main fire department downtown, got to meet with this is in Seattle, Chief Claude Harris. He was the first African-American, not just fire chief, but firefighter. And when the news came in I had won, My mom said, you know, your brother gets to share this with you because he's a boy. And because he's a boy, he'll appreciate being fire chief for the day, you know, more so than you. First of all, I'm obviously still have issues with this. My brother knows this. And he'll bring it up, like, remember when we were fire chief for the day? We both got our own helmets. We both, with our names on them, we both got to go through downtown Seattle on a fire truck. We both got to eat at a very fancy restaurant where I ordered a modest ham and cheese sandwich. And my brother got Dungeness crab. Like, he really lived it up. And you know what? I'm going to say that this was beneficial to him because he is a chef now. So ordering that $24 Dungeness crab plate, you know, really, I really feel like I planted the seed for him to be a chef. I was forced to share this victory and this achievement with a boy because he was a boy. And I love my brother, but I will say that, you know, for him as a chef now, he has a delicious pasta that he makes with anchovies, and I just take credit for it. I make it all the time. It's my recipe. And if you ever go eat at his restaurants in New York City and have this anchovy pasta with Parmesan and lemon, I invented that.
It's a lot about sexism in a nutshell because, you know, I've done a huge amount of interviewing around gender-based violence in Latin America. And honestly, I mean, there are just so many stories that have been told to me about differential treatment of siblings based on gender and how mothers specifically, right? I mean, these stories are always around mothers. I think maybe because it's even, you know, adds insult to injury when it's your mom who is telling you to serve your brother, right? I mean, the stories that I hear, you know, out of Latin America are more like, let your brother sit down at the table and you know, set the table while he just sits there and rests because he's a boy and you're a girl. And, you know, this is maybe not quite as egregious, but also is in that exact same vein.
It's a microaggression that we all know piles up and creates this calcification in our culture. And for me, it's not like my brother went on to be a fireman. So to hear that this, you know, that these things happen, and, you know, I mean, I was outraged then. I'm clearly outraged now. And I still operate from a place of like, please don't be inspired by me. Please don't, you know, make art. Don't like my art that much, you know. And when I talk to young artists, it's like, find your voice, you know, find your unique vision. Find what you do best that's uniquely you. And it takes a lot of sifting and a lot of introspection to get there. It's not going to happen overnight. It is the process of creation that you're exploring. But what do you bring to the table? What do you have to offer?
Absolutely. And finding that, you know, unique you in your art, I think is the best advice. And then finding a way to actually articulate that uniqueness is also really, I think, important, because that is where you start to have some really compelling language to put into a grant application or, you know, a different kind of application or call to artists that can really set you apart. Lex, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I mean, I know that when we chatted prior to this, I spoke about, you know, with you about how, you know, I really feel like these flower mounds are here to stay, and that, you know, I could really be operating and working with them for a while. And then, you know, between that conversation and now, I kept reflecting on like, why do I feel that? It's so weird. Like maybe that's, you know, it's so definitive to say like, oh, I'm going to be, this is it for me. Flower mounds are nothing. I don't know. I just couldn't, you know, maybe you can help me with it. And, you know, I couldn't figure out like, I feel like maybe the reason I said that was because this all feels unending. You know, I really got it out of my brain, you know, week 3 of quarantine, like, oh, when this ends, I will do this. And it's not, you know, we had that after 9/11. We had, you know, we keep saying that like, oh, well, when this ends, it's going to be this. And that's not really how the world reconfigures itself. I mean, I will continue to work from a place of this radical happiness and joy. I mean, there it is tears of a clown, obviously, but yeah, I just, you know, I'm creating unending work because in a positive way, it feels unending, not in a depressed way, it feels unending.
And I absolutely can relate to that because for me, all of my worry right now is around sustainability. Like, what kind of life can I create within this pandemic that is sustainable? Because I don't know how long it's going to go on, right? How long will I really have to live within the confines of social distancing, et cetera? You know, it's, is it going to be 6 months? Is it going to be a year? Whatever it is that I figure out for the ebbs and flows of my life, I feel like it has to be something that can last for at least a year and that I can be happy with for a kind of undetermined amount of time, because I really just need to get into a rhythm that I find sustainable for my peace of mind.
Sustainability is a huge expectation. You know, that brings on a lot of like, there won't be days and there won't be moments, you know, and there won't be highs and lows. So for me, it's like, you know, maybe for me, it's more like coping, like, you know, I'm going to get into taking baths like nobody's business. And then at some point, like taking a bath is not going to bring me the same joy. And then I'll get into like, well, I'm just going to eat Dairy Queen for dinner. You know, so it's like small delights in the moment, you know, and I mean, you and I both, we manage our families and we have children. You know, there are other factors at play. It's not just us. I don't know. I'm an intense person and I really love that this time offers me a time that I'm allowed to be super intense with my family. Like, it's me and my husband and my child, and I'm not wasting a minute and I'm not taken away from them. And they would probably say otherwise about this intensity, but as you know, we didn't have air conditioning for like 10 days. That really, so we went from just being in one house to being into one room. And I sent a friend a photo of us and she was like, oh, that's very proof of life. Like, we all were sweating and, but we still found joy in popsicles and we still found, like, I just keep being like, guys, this is the time of our lives. These are the golden years. So if we can't do it now, like, if you can't find joy in these intense times, you're not going to find it when you're allowed to do whatever you want, because you won't even know what to do with it.
A show, I started binge watching a show that a friend turned us on to. It's called Alone. It's on the History Channel. And it's about survivalists. So they take take these survivalists and just like dump them in the middle of nowhere. And they're like, okay, survive for as long as you can. And you can tap out whenever you want. But the you can't win unless you're the last person standing, basically, right? So these people go through these really intense psychological tests of being in isolation, of not having sufficient calories because they're, you know, like whatever, eating seaweed and snails. And
is this
like,
what's going on in your house? Is that what you're saying? Like,
I guess the parallel that I find is that, you know, in a lot of ways, I feel like this is our new life is like everything stripped down to the basics. And then how do we build on that? Right? Well, like,
see, because I'm streaming and binge watching, like I fell into a hole of like, I'm watching shows about people with like too many babies. Like, I'm watching like the opposite, but yet the same grueling, like, you know, six babies, they all need diapers changed. They all are crying. One baby's biting another baby. One baby's slamming a baby's head down. And I'm like, my daughter just keeps going, you just keep saying, this is why I had one kid. And I'm like, so it's kind of, it parallels it, but in a different way. Look, there are a lot of babies out there. People with lots of babies.
Lex, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's just been delightful.
Oh, I'm so glad you invited me to chat. And yeah, I hope we can see each other soon again.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. Support for Artist Stories is provided by Benjamin Supply, presenting a full spectrum of hardware and plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath, and their gallery, Tucson, offering national and local art in both the Tucson Warehouse and Transfer Buildings on 6th Street and 7th Avenue. With products available at will call, they are currently open by phone at 777-7000 and at benjaminsupply.com or gallerytucson.com.